For our Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 7 p.m.
This is Texas Monthly, the national magazine of Texas. Articles and features read by volunteers and staff at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Food and Drink, Pat's Pick, by Patricia Sharp, photographs by Jody Horton. More to Love at Mishley. This exceptional San Antonio restaurant has expanded into a larger space without shrinking any of its ambitions. Something ice cold is always in order on a warm San Antonio evening. So as soon as we arrived at Mishley, my friend Jenny and I slid into chairs at one of 13 well-spaced tables and ordered lavender lemonades. Then we took a minute to gaze around the room with its high ceiling, clean lined furniture, and pops of blue in everything, from glassware to whimsical art. The masked staff moved quietly between the dining area and open kitchen while we inspected the 10-course tasting menu, which changes roughly with the seasons, each iteration focusing on the culinary traditions of one of Mexico's wildly varied regions, states, or historic periods. This was my first visit to Mishley in several years, and I was happy to see that chef owners Diego Galicia and Rico Torres have stayed true to their mission, exploring Mexican cuisine from ancient to modern times through the lens of their singular imaginations. Sustaining that sort of vision is not always easy when a small acclaimed restaurant expands or moves, and Mishley has recently done both. It's no longer in its original location, the charmingly renovated railroad car in an almost park shopping center where it all started. Back in 2013, the then 30-year-old Galicia, who is from Toluca, Mexico, and 35-year-old Torres, an El Paso native, had taken a leap of faith, abandoning solid jobs to follow a risky, quixotic path. Galicia remembers, "I was like, hey man, if you jump, I'll jump." They pulled $15,000 and leased the rail car, which they turned into a restaurant with one long 12-seat communal table. The poetic name they chose, pronounced Mishtli, means cloud in Nahuatl, the language of the Aztecs, and some of their descendants. Initially, Galicia and Torres weren't even convinced that diners would want to eat dishes inspired by ancient ideas, so they were astonished when the place became a runaway hit. Foodies flocked from Chicago, New York, and other far-flung cities, and professional recognition followed. In 2017, Food and Wine named the pair to its list of best new chefs in the country. A year later, they were semifinalists for the James Beard Foundation's Best Chef Southwest Award. "When he learned of the nomination, I couldn't stop crying," Galicia told me at the time. But even as the accolades piled up, the appeal of the tiny quarters began to wear thin. "There were no windows in the kitchen," says Galicia. "That gets to you after a while." As demand for those 12 seats skyrocketed, the owners had a new dream: ditch the rail car. After considerable searching, they found an airy location in the flourishing South Town neighborhood. True to form, the thrifty co-owners designed the space and selected the furniture and art themselves. The new place opened in June. Sitting in that new room, Jenny and I sipped our drinks, eager to see what novelties the chefs had devised for the inaugural menu, which paid homage to the cuisine of Oaxaca. Would there be a Zapotec dish? An edible insect or two? Soon a tray arrived bearing two beautifully browned, perfectly spherical dinner rolls. Well, of course, French ingredients and cooking techniques had been a key part of Mexico's culinary culture even before the 5 years of French occupation under Napoleon III in the 1860s. One bite later, we looked up simultaneously. These were the most ethereal, no, celestial, rolls either of us had ever eaten. Accenting the yeasty goodness was a subliminal hint of infused smoke. And that sweetness? Executive pastry chef Sofia Tejeda had added whey for extra depth. Alongside the bread were a small wooden bowl of butter topped with jet black huitlacoche salt from Mexico's intriguing and delicious corn fungus, and a matching vessel filled with olive oil scented with nasturtium leaf. We sat back and thought, how are they going to top this? I read the second listed item. It says, ceviche of calabacita. I remarked, wondering what a squash ceviche could be. The plate arrived and we were further perplexed. Isn't that a granita? The green and yellow composition turned out to be both. On one side was a tidy mound of ice crystals from a frozen puree of peas and serrano peppers, while on the other was a lime juice tossed ceviche of not just squash but also other vegetables, including delicately charred cucumber. Epazote vinaigrette added an herbal punch, and underneath it all was a layer of garlicky avocado mousse. You should stir everything together, our server instructed. We did, trying to include some of the dish's final garnish, crunchy chicatana ants in each bite. These croutons of the insect world, about 3/4 of an inch long, are mild, a little bit nutty, and quite tasty. Just like that, we had been swept into Michtli's carefully planned evening, drama building with the entrance and exit of each course. The next to arrive was a black disc, about the size of a large cookie, sprinkled with glistening orange trout roe and bright green sunflower sprouts. Under the colorful garnish was a shiny thatch of black sesame seeds. The middle layer held the generous payoff, a spread made from the rare smoky Oaxacan chile called pasilla miche, and finely chopped freshwater mussels, tachindas, from the same region. The bottom was a tidy round cake of squid ink flavored masa. Not to worry, it was sweet, not fishy. Pick it up, our server said. The dish, eaten by hand, made for savory, almost meaty bites. In my several decades of reviewing Texas restaurants and visiting some of the world's most celebrated dining venues, I've never had anything quite like it, which I suspect is exactly what Galicia and Torres were going for. After the first few courses, we fell in step with Michtli's pacing, savoring each item, happy we had no decisions to make. We watched as new guests settled in and reacted with astonishment to the dishes we had just enjoyed. During the occasional brief lull, Torres or Galicia might appear with an unusual ingredient, kneeling beside a table to talk about it with genuine enthusiasm. The most sensational presentation came about halfway through, in a cloud of dry ice. The white vapor billowing up from beneath a bed of seaweed arranged in a smooth earthenware bowl. Atop the dark green vegetation were two white seashells, each holding a velvety bay scallop that had been poached in ajo chile butter. Of the remaining courses, the two most straightforward were obviously calculated to please carnivores. One was a hunk of Iberico pork tenderloin belted in hoja santa leaves, which lent just a touch of anise and eucalyptus. Under the pink sous vide protein was a marigold-hued mole of chile costeño, amarillo, blended with Texas-grown peanuts. The other substantial item was tender grass-fed ribeye, 4 medium-rare slices sided by an ebony pool of mole negro. This dish was the showplace for a particularly rare chile, the chilhuacle negro, one of many that the owners have gone to considerable lengths to source. Some are so scarce, Torres told us, that they're produced in only one or two little villages. But the course that left us with the biggest smiles was the playful finale. An array of sweets called Study of Oaxaca. Created by Tejeda, it arrived on an imposing wooden platter that was in fact a cross-section of a small tree limb. Beautiful, striking dinnerware is a distinct part of the pleasure of a meal at Mixtli. The base of the dessert was a slice of almond cake, half buried in an avalanche of crumbs, finely chopped almonds, nibbles of dried fruits, and colorful flower petals. On top was a milky white dome of what looked like sherbet, but was in fact a custard inspired by the Zapotec dish, Miquatole. It was so smooth that I would never have guessed the base was masa. A fat squiggle of chocolate ganache completed the creation. At the end of the meal, Torres stopped by to ask, "Are you going to the bar for coffee?" We were tempted. Café de Ola, fragrant coffee spiced with cinnamon and raw sugar, and brewed in a clay pot, is one of Mexico's loveliest traditions. But at this point, I couldn't eat another bite, so I just peeked into the comfy adjacent room, which features an appropriate art installation of a glowing cloud, and promised I'd indulge next time. No reservations are required for the bar, which also offers a snack menu. Walking out into the late summer night, I felt the way I had the first time I ate at Mixtli in the rail car 8 years ago, exhilarated. Also, frankly, relieved. I had worried that the pressure of the pandemic would have forced the two owners to scale back, to go more mainstream. But they are as ambitious as ever. I remembered something that Galicia told me back in 2018. "This restaurant is going places," he said. "Rico and I just follow it. We just run behind it, trying to keep up. It's become a very special place." It was then, and it still is. Mixtli's menu changes 4 times a year. For the fall, the cuisine of Chiapas is being featured until December 18th. Online reservations by prepaid ticket only. $125 per person. Optional wine pairings, $50 per person. Café de Ola for two, $20. Mixtli, 812 South Alamo, San Antonio. Phone 210-338-0746. Dinner Tuesday through Saturday, more than $60. Opened October 1st, 2013. Reopened June 22nd, 2021.
My Little Clony by Madeline Agler. Illustration by Justin Metz. You love your pet. You love her so much that if you could, you'd buy an exact copy of her. Well, you can. Take it from Blake Russell, president of Viagen Pets and Equine, and owner of a very unusual horse farm. To the casual motorist driving down the long, flat country road outside Gainesville, an hour north of Dallas, Blake Russell's 80-acre horse farm probably looks like any other in the area. The wide green pastures are dotted with hay racks and bored-looking mares flicking away flies with their silken tails. A steel ranch sign depicting a man, a woman, and 2 horses crowded around a cross hangs over a narrow driveway that winds up a hill to a cozy limestone house. but a particularly observant traveler might take note of the unusually wide variety of breeds represented in the fields. There are compact, reliable American quarter horses, a Frisian with a glossy black mane of a shampoo model, draft horses the size of Airstream trailers, and a Dutch warm blood with long legs and the haughty, regal demeanor of minor European nobility. One might wonder how a veritable United Nations of the equine world ended up here in Cook County. And maybe if the motorist had an especially keen eye for such things, she would remark upon how similar those two sorrel fillies look, or how that chubby blue roan bears an uncanny resemblance to a famous cutting horse. But even then, she probably wouldn't guess what's really going on here. You don't generally assume you're looking at clones, after all. This is no regular horse farm, and Blake Russell is no regular horse farmer. Russell is the president of Viagen Pets and Equine, a prolific commercial animal cloning facility. The company primarily clones cats, dogs, and horses, though it has also cloned pigs, cows, and sheep. More recently, Viagen started applying its technology to conservation efforts, cloning an endangered Przewalski's horse, Kurt, for the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance, and an endangered black-footed ferret named Elizabeth Ann for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. You name it, Viagen can clone it for you, just as long as it is a non-primate mammal and you are someone with tens of thousands of dollars to spare. Replicating your beloved Pomeranian will set you back $50,000. Cloning a horse costs $85,000. Cats are a steal at $35,000. Russell said the cat side of the business hasn't taken off the way the other two have, though. He's not sure why, but offered, "Cat people and dog people are very different." These prices are prohibitively expensive for most, and questions remain about the ethics and implications of commercial cloning, but the practice is increasingly popular. Viagen is one of just a couple companies around the world that provide the service to ranchers hoping to strengthen their stock, to equestrian athletes looking to replicate dependable steeds, and to wealthy pet owners who want to enjoy a copy of their beloved animal companions. Viagen's headquarters is just north of Austin, in Cedar Park, but ever since Russell bought his farm in 2018, he's started bringing more of his work home with him, so to speak. He cares for some of the company's pregnant surrogates and their clone babies here in his personal stables with the help of visiting Viagen employees, farm staff, and his family. On the day I visited, Russell guessed that there were about 150 Viagen horses on the property, or on nearby tracks he uses, pregnant surrogate mares, soon-to-be pregnant mares, and postpartum mares that are raising their newborn clones until they are old enough to be sent off to their new homes. Surrogates that are too old to bear any more colts often remain with the other horses just to keep them company. At one point, while we were petting a young filly clone who was about to be shipped off to Belgium to begin her new show-jumping career, Russell pointed out a group of four mares clustered around a nearby fence, eyeing us suspiciously, like a group of long-faced middle schoolers scoping out a new girl from across the school cafeteria. Three or four were pregnant, he explained, but the fourth, a small chestnut, stayed with the others because she was a really close friend. Most of the farm's operations related to Viagen, but Russell also has 20 horses of his own that he and his family ride, including two clones. One, Royal Blue Boone II, is a 72-year-old blue roan quarter horse mare derived from a revered cutting horse. This current iteration of Boone is a tick too fat for her age, Russell admitted, but we just love her so much we can't tell her no. Russell is similarly indulgent with his second clone, Pure Taylor Fit, whom I saw from a distance at first and then, suddenly, right up close. Fit, as Russell and his family call him, is a 15-year-old stallion copied from a late gelding Taylor Fit, the two-time world champion racing quarter horse. He's a muscular, stocky bay who maintains his physique by spending long hours trotting back and forth in the paddock, trying to impress the mares in the field across the way. On the surprisingly tolerable day in August that Russell showed me around the farm, Fit dashed to the edge of his enclosure to meet us. Alarmingly, he made his approach butt first, his huge, glossy rump speeding towards our faces, like a great mahogany moon blotting out the sky. Though admittedly no equestrian, I know that when a horse aims its back end at you, it's usually bad news. I calculated that despite the sturdy wire fence between us, a swift, strong kick of Fit's rear leg could, depending on the angle of propulsion, easily pulverize my pelvic cradle or my kneecap. Russell, standing next to me, seemed unfazed, so I held still, trying to look as blasé as one possibly can when every muscle in one's body is fully tensed and braced for impact. When Fit's rear pressed against the fence, I scanned him for any signs that he was getting ready to two-step along my skeleton. He appeared to be relaxed, though, as did Russell, who reached out and scratched the base of the stallion's tail. As he did, he looked at me apologetically. "This wasn't a clone thing," he explained. "When he was a baby, we rubbed his butt all the time," he said. "I'm a horse person, I knew better. But I would sit in a lawn chair in his pen when he was a baby, and he would back in and I would rub his tail head right here. And then he'd want to sit in my lap, and I knew better. That's a terrible thing to teach a horse that's going to get to 1,200 pounds. But he loved it so much I just couldn't stop. So nowadays he'll see me, and he'll say, 'Hey, come rub my butt.'" Not wanting to seem like an ungrateful guest, I also reached out and rubbed Fit's butt. The stallion leaned deeper into the fence, his ears twitching happily. President of an animal cloning company is a title that evokes a C-list James Bond villain, one who wears overly shiny suits and is intent on disrupting the world order with armies of cloned panthers or something. But Russell didn't cut a sinister figure. He described himself as a part-time cowboy. He and his family and friends were out roping until almost midnight the night before, and he showed me around the farm in jeans and a light blue shirt. By the time I left, he had invited me and my immediate family to come back any time and stay in one of the multiple guest houses on his farm, eat his food, and ride his horses. In fact, he was slightly distressed that I hadn't come for dinner the previous evening. Did I have enough water for the drive back, he wanted to know? Was I sure? The only time Russell did resemble a movie villain was when he scooped up a small white barn cat with a glittery pink collar, cradled her in his arms a la Dr. Evil, and informed me that her name was Warhawk. Still, I experienced a disorienting conversational whiplash throughout the day. One minute, I was meeting Russell's daughter, Lexi, who told me how she and her college rodeo team went to the nationals in Wyoming this year. The next, Viagen's chief science officer, Sean Walker, a tall, bespectacled geneticist with a voice like a double bass, was discussing the possibility of resuscitating endangered species populations, and I was shown clones that I can't describe here in any way because their famous owners have insisted on the utmost secrecy. It was like attending a nice family get-together aboard the Starship Enterprise. It all started with Dolly, sort of. In February 1997, scientists at Scotland's Roslin Institute introduced Dolly, the sheep, to the world. But she wasn't the first animal to be cloned. Back in 1891, German biologist Hans Driesch created a pair of sea urchins by splitting a single sea urchin embryo in half. And in 1903, another German Hans embryologist, Hans Spemann, formed salamander larvae after he sliced a salamander embryo in two using a tiny, delicate hair from his baby's head. Decades after that, in 1952, American scientists Robert Briggs and Thomas King successfully cloned tadpoles using nuclear transfer, the same technique that would be used to create Dolly more than 40 years later. Wherein the DNA formed an egg is removed and the nucleus injected with the DNA of the animal one seeks to clone. Dolly wasn't even the first Dolly, really. Before she was born, there were 277 unsuccessful attempts to clone the 6-year-old Finn Dorset sheep the Roslin Institute scientists had selected for their experiment. One of those attempts, only 29, resulted in embryos that were implanted in surrogate mothers, and of those embryos, Dolly was the only one that survived to full term. What made Dolly special, besides her name, which the research team bestowed upon her because she was cloned from a mammary gland, and they couldn't think of a more impressive pair of glands than Dolly Parton's, was that she was the first creature to be successfully cloned from an adult somatic cell. Previously, scientists had managed to create clones only from embryos, meaning that the resulting animals were clones of each other, rather than clones of an existing animal. Clones are, in effect, genetic twins, and this new technology allowed scientists to create twins of an animal that would be born at a later date than the original, as opposed to at the same time. As with most gigantic scientific leaps forward, Dolly's existence was greeted with both wonder and panic. If scientists could clone a sheep, Manning wondered, how long until they could clone a human? And what were the implications of that? Even Dr. Ian Wilmot, the head embryologist behind the Dolly experiment, expressed concerns about the science being misused, telling the press in 1997 that he found the idea of human cloning offensive, and that it would be desperately sad if people started using this technology with people. After Dolly's birth, the UN spent years studying and debating the big, messy ethical questions of cloning before releasing in 2005 its Declaration on Human Cloning, a document that prohibited, somewhat ambiguously, all forms of human cloning inasmuch as they are incompatible with human dignity and the protection of human life. That didn't do much to clear up the confusion, and countries across the globe began to adopt their own laws regarding human cloning. Some, like France and Germany, banned it outright, while others, like the UK, banned reproductive cloning with the goal of creating a newborn baby that is genetically identical to another human, but allowed the use of cloned human embryos for biomedical research. Back in the U.S., there was a backlash from animal rights groups, including the Humane Society, which views commercial cloning as an abuse of humanity's power over the animal world that should be prohibited by law, and the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, which called for a moratorium on the research, promotion, and sale of cloned and bioengineered pets. But for every objector, it seemed, there were just as many consumers out there willing to pay big bucks to get their favorite animals duplicated and triplicated. It was here that Viagen founder John Sperling, who also founded the University of Phoenix, saw an opportunity. Sperling, the Howard Hughes of biotech, according to Wired, was an eccentric billionaire with a keen interest in genetic and longevity research. A year after the Dolly announcement, he donated millions to Texas A&M University to help fund a dog cloning project that became known as the Missiplicity Project. After Missy, the husky mix that Sperling intended to clone. Though the original Missy passed away in 2002, four clones were eventually produced in 2007 and 2008. Sperling started collecting existing patents and intellectual property related to cloning and amassed a team of experts who would be able to make his commercial animal cloning dreams a reality. He started with the science side, scooping up experts such as Walker, the Viagen CSO, who has a PhD in genetics from A&M. Then, Sperling brought in business people, including Russell, who was then working for a UK-based animal breeding company called PIC, short for Pig Improvement Company, to help sell the dream. It became Russell's job to make a brand new, ever-evolving, and still ethically confusing practice appear appealing, approachable, and dependable. A task to which he seemed preternaturally well-suited. He exudes the kind of appealing, approachable, and dependable energy necessary to calm a skittish horse or make a tough sale. As a child, Russell wanted to be a vet. He loved animals, and his family always seemed to need a vet on their farm in southern Oklahoma. Russell's dad bred and raced quarter horses, and Russell grew up riding them, tending to them, and learning the intricacies of breeding them. He knew he wanted to work with them when he grew up, but horses are expensive, and it's hard to make a comfortable living from breeding and racing alone. I was always raised with my family telling me, if you want to be in the horse business, you better have a great other job, Russell recalled. Russell studied animal science at Oklahoma State University, and he quickly found that there were two tracks you could take in the world of genetics, the technical side, where you got a PhD and conducted research, and the business side, where you got paid. He chose the latter. After graduating, he went to work for PIC, which later paid for him to get an MBA from Emory University in Atlanta. In 2005, when Sperling offered him the chance to be part of an animal cloning company, he jumped at it. When Dolly came out, that created a whole different set of questions for us to think through, Russell said. I got kind of jazzed by what that might mean. Viagen started with livestock. Cloning was popular with farmers and ranchers who used it to optimize desirable characteristics in cattle, pigs, and sheep by cloning and breeding the animals with the strongest genes. Over time, the cloning process evolved and became increasingly reliable. Researchers became more efficient at drawing out DNA from genetic samples and creating viable embryos. About 5 years ago, the company expanded its services to offer the cloning of companion animals, and in 2018, Russell and Walker decided to separate pet and equine operations from the rest of the business. When you're cloning a companion animal, it's a whole different set of emotions, Russell explained. It just became clear to us. Hey, these things are going in different directions. Viagen's livestock operations remained with Transova Genetics, run by Dr. David Faber, and many staffers joined Russell and Walker in what became Viagen's pet and equine. Both Russell and a representative from Transova said the divorce was amicable. In an anonymous beige office complex in Cedar Park, Viagen Pets and Equine is tucked between a physical therapist's office and an audiovisual company. Inside, the walls are covered in blown-up photographs of clients' clones, each emblazoned along the bottom with Viagen, fuzzy kittens, a pair of identical Dobermans, a sweet fowl, and two jaunty poodle puppies standing next to an older dog, their antecedent poodle. At the back of the office is a lab where staffers process the DNA from the tissue sample collection kits that they send out to the clients. In order to ensure the tissue is in good enough condition for DNA collection, the company recommends that owners, or preferably their vets, biopsy pets while they're alive or, at the very latest, within the first few days after a pet's death. When Sinaz Arinovis, Viagen's cell culture manager, explained to me the difficulty of cloning genetic material that hasn't been properly preserved, I nodded and mentally scratched off "Can Jurassic Park happen and when?" from my list of questions. Once a DNA sample arrives at the lab, Viagen harvests living cells from the sample. If the client doesn't want to clone the pet immediately, the cells are frozen and stored in one of the company's massive cryogenic vats where they can be kept indefinitely until the client is ready to clone. When the time comes, the scientists perform a procedure called somatic cell nuclear transfer, taking the cloned cell of the original pet and implanting it into the nucleus of a female's egg. Once the cloned embryo has successfully started to grow in the egg is implanted into a surrogate mother who carries the egg to term and delivers the baby just as she might in any other pregnancy. The surrogates don't treat the clones any differently than they would their own brood, Russell told me. It's their baby. They look after it like it's their baby. Viagen also enlists a third-party lab to perform DNA tests on every cloned animal so that owners can rest assured that the pet they receive is indeed a clone of their cherished pet and not some random puppy. Because when clients drop significant sums of money on Fido II, they typically have one big question: just how similar are clones to their originals? If you think about identical twins in humans, if you look for the similarities, you see them. If you look for the differences, you see them, Russell said as he sat in his sunroom underneath a large photo of six wolf hybrid puppies he had cloned for a client. Still, he said, the similarities are uncanny. He and Walker described cloned horses who will stand in the same spots in a field as their original, who enjoy being scratched in the same places, and who seem to like and dislike the same people. You think about the guys that debated nature versus nurture. Before cloning, there was really no way to dispute one or the other. By now, with cloning, you can actually physically see it, said Russell. Genetics are more powerful than we ever dreamed. Stubborn misconceptions about cloning are serious marketing hurdles for Viagen. The biggest one is that cloned animals have more health problems than other animals and or age prematurely. That rumor started circulating after Dolly developed osteoarthritis in her knee and died at age 6 after contracting a virus that causes lung tumors. Scientists later determined that her having been cloned had nothing to do with the development of osteoarthritis. At least, since then, other Dolly clones have gone on to lead long, rich lives full of delicious roughage and occasional biomedical experimentation. But this belief is so pervasive, Russell said, that even when he shows visitors his own healthy clones, such as Fit, they express concern about the horse's life expectancy. Some clients forget that the clone of their adult pet will not emerge from the womb as an adult. People will clone their dog, and when they realize, oh gosh, I wasn't ready for a puppy, Russell said. The newly initiated may also have difficulty accepting that clones are just regular animals. I found myself scanning Viagen's downy-tailed foals for signs of their sci-fi origins, a light neon glow around them, perhaps, or the faint whirring sound of a motor deep in their guts. But all I saw were normal, spindle-legged babies who sniffed my hand curiously before wobbling nervously on tiny teacup-sized hooves back to the safety of their surrogate mother's side. When a cloned animal is before you, the fact that it is the physical embodiment of some of the most advanced biomedical technology of our time seems almost incidental, like when someone tells you they're from Cleveland or that they don't care for salmon. It's easy to see why clones are still so misunderstood. They're not talked about often, even among those who own them, much to the dismay of Russell and Viagen's marketing team. The company has had many celebrity clients, he said, but almost all of them choose to remain anonymous. And with good reason. After Barbara Streisand, a Viagen client, told Variety in 2018 that she had purchased two clones of her 14-year-old Coton de Tulier dog, Samantha, online critics deemed the decision shameful and insane and evil. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals issued a statement in response to the following news, calling Streisand's decision a folly and saying that cloning is a horror show. So, Russell understands clients' reluctance to go public with their clones, but he looked wistful as he talked about how great it would be for business if customers were more open about having used the service. And as for the adopt, don't shop crowd, Russell said he was not touching that issue, though he noted that cloned animals aren't the ones filling shelters. Every animal that we produce has a home before we produce it, right? While Russell, Walker, and I sat in the sunroom discussing the ethics of cloning, Lexi was busy running a rodeo camp behind the house. She was trying to teach a gaggle of elementary children how to rope a calf. The campers looked impossibly small on their steeds, like Polly Pocket dolls strapped to briar horse figurines, but they rode confidently, darting around and across the paddock, trying to cut off the calf's escape. When they got in the right position, the kids flung their ropes into the air, but the calf easily dodged them. At the end of the lesson, the group looked deflated. "Every morning they think they're going to be professionals at this by now," Lexi said later. "They get quickly discouraged when they realize they're not yet." Rodeo is big in Russell's family, which is just as well, because it's one of the sports in which clones are allowed to compete. Physically, cloned horses can do anything a regular horse can do, but bureaucratically, things aren't so simple. Much like the complex constellation of cloning laws that exist in the human world, in the horse world, the rules regarding cloned animals differ wildly between sports and breed associations. The largest horse breed registry in the world, for example, the American Quarter Horse Association, does not register clones. As a result, cloned quarter horses are not eligible to compete in lucrative AQHA breeding, racing, or show programs. In an email, an AQHA representative laid out some of the group's concerns about clones, that the consequences of cloning are not yet clear, that the introduction of clones into the registry makes parentage verification difficult because it poses certain challenges to AQHA's ability to differentiate between horses, and that the potential of cloning to intensify the narrowing of the gene pool results in the worsening of known and unknown genetic diseases or the creation of a new genetic disease. In some sports, though, like polo, cloned horses are increasingly well represented. Over the course of a polo match, Riders will swap out horses several times. With clones, instead of hopping on a different animal and having to adjust to a different size and stride, a player can jump onto the original horse's genetic twin, thereby reducing the friction of that transition, Russell explained. Polo players are big money for Viagen because instead of ordering one or two clones of a horse, they may order 5 or 10 that they can ride during games. Russell attributed clones' popularity in the sport to the fact that Adolfo Cambiasso, one of the top players in the world, frequently rides clones of his deceased stallion, Akin Cura. Viagens helped produce several of Cambioso's clones early on. After polo, Russell said, show jumping is the sport for which Viagen gets the most clone requests. There weren't any clones at the Olympics this year, but Russell thinks that he has more to do with timing than anything else. It can take 10 years for a jumper to be Olympics ready, and, he said, most clones in the sport simply aren't old enough yet. He's hopeful some clones will appear in the Paris Olympic Games in 2024. But, given the high levels of secrecy many of his clients choose to maintain, it's quite possible no one would ever know if they did. They might not even tell us, he said. Some clients declined to give Viagen any details about the original animal besides its species and size. For the time being, Russell seems to have found a happy balance between farm life and his work reshaping the world of genetics, partly by centering his business around the more ethically palatable area of pet cloning. That's why right now, for instance, Viagen will clone only non-primate mammals. The human cloning questions, the primate cloning questions, we're out of that. We don't entertain it, he said. Nor does Viagen offer gene editing services for the animals it produces. Another slippery ethical slope it hopes to avoid. If the horse you want to clone had a genetic heart condition, the clone will likely have the same condition. Russell was conservative when he discussed the future of cloning. While Viagen's business had grown in recent years, theirs is still a niche luxury product. The company does not release exact numbers, but it has produced more than 1,000 cloned horses and about the same number of cloned dogs and cats combined, Russell said. Even if cloning technology advances to the point where the company could start cranking out clones at a rapid rate, Russell said, that's not something he's particularly interested in. People don't want us to look like a factory. In cloning, as with other areas of animal production and preservation, the lines consumers and producers draw are at once firm and somewhat arbitrary. In the U.S., we eat pigs, one of the most intelligent animals, but we would never eat dogs. We clone, but not too much, and not primates. Though the intellectual and moral inconsistencies of these beliefs become apparent under even the lightest questioning, we cling to them. These lines seem to exist less for the animals' well-being and more for our own comfort as a way to reassure ourselves that although humanity continues to press its thumb heavily on the scales of nature, it's doing so in a thoughtful, reasonable way, right? Animal cloning doesn't seem likely to reshape the face of the planet anytime soon. As Russell told me, you're not going to wake up in 10 years and all of your neighbors are going to have cloned pets. Though, I suppose, how could you tell?
Arts and Entertainment Chat by Richard Z. Santos, photographed by Nick Simonite. Piece de Revision. Author Sandra Cisneros on Staying Hopeful, The Agony of Revising and Publishing Her New Novella 30 Years After She Started It. Before I could ask my first question for our interview, Sandra Cisneros and I had already talked about social media. Her advice: Writers don't have time to fritter on Twitter. Certain politicians whose mothers need to give them a nalgada with a chancla, a spanking with a sandal, and where I could find a solo itzcuintli, a hairless breed of dog. The 66-year-old former San Antonio resident, who now lives in the Mexican city of San Miguel de Allende, is a patron saint of Hispanic literature. Her Macondo Writers Workshop has helped launch dozens of careers. The House on Mango Street, Cisneros' 1984 debut novel, has sold more than 7 million copies and remains a classroom staple. Her newest book, the dual-language novella, Martita, I Remember You, Martita, Te Recuerdo, was published in September with the Spanish translation by Austin-based Liliana Valenzuela. Texas Monthly. With all that's happening right now, where can we find hope? Sandra Cisneros. I have hope. I'm an optimist. I'm always waiting and asking, where's our Gandhi, our Dr. King, our Cesar Chavez? I'm always looking for those leaders, and maybe they're us. We all have to make that change we want to see. Someone said that. Was it Gandhi? Or was it just a bumper sticker I saw in Austin? But I think it's up to us to be very mindful. I know I've been guilty of speaking when angry. We don't have to be the Buddha, but what language are we using? What examples are we putting out there, especially when we write? What helps ground you? I always go to Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese monk. I read him and pow, that's the chanclada I get if I'm angry or say something I regret. And other poets too. I have Joy Harjo at my bedside. Also, Edwidge Danticat's Create Dangerously. These are my spiritual leaders. What's your revision process like, and has it become easier over the years? It's irritating at first, death-defying and slow as hell, and I'm always convinced it will kill me. Each book becomes more difficult as I get older, because I demand more of myself. If I can, I let a manuscript sleep for a few months or weeks or days. I write lots of other things when I'm stuck, poetry, essays, or I read or draw. I think it opens up the mind to get off the track and look at something else. I love looking at paintings or watching a documentary or watching another art form like dance. The protagonist of Martita, Corina, rediscovers letters from friends she met in Paris decades earlier, then spends much of the book processing her past. Was that part of the genesis of the story? This story was originally part of Woman Hollering Creek, so I wrote it first in the 80s or at the beginning of the 90s. It was one of a few that didn't make it into the collection because it wasn't finished. So I put it away and thought I'd come back to it later. My life just kind of got swept up after that, but my friend Dennis Mathis from the University of Iowa, where Cisneros earned her MFA in creative writing, kept asking me when I was going to finish that story. I was always working on poetry, a novel, and so on, but I finally had some time and I pulled it out. So, you had time because of the COVID-19 pandemic? Yes. During the last presidency, I would accept any offer to travel and speak because I felt a responsibility to encourage and teach young people. That was my ministry. Then the pandemic was a way almost to have a retreat and finish things. I had files and files of notes from my editors and from Dennis. All of them, like my head, dusty. So I had to clear everything out and finish it, and I have the age, perspective, and I hope, wisdom, that I didn't have when I was younger. How much of the book is drawn from your time in Europe in your 20s? When I was traveling on my NEA, National Endowment for the Arts, grant, I was 28 or 29. I had a Eurail pass, and that's how I traveled to lots of different places. Some of the stories in the book are mine, and others are composites of the women I met and the stories they told me. I guess I'm all three women characters, but also none of them. I started from an autobiographical place because so many weird things happened to me when I was traveling. But when I came home, no one wanted to hear them. Karina was broke in Paris. She couldn't afford to tour the Eiffel Tower. Why does she hold on to those memories? It's the memories we wish we could forget. I always tell young writers, don't write about what you wish you could remember. Write about what you can't forget. Those memories stay, and there's something transformational about them. Sometimes people stay with us for reasons we don't understand until we can write about them. I think of the story as a letter unwritten. You think of someone and say, oh, I would say this or that to them. Where are they now? Maybe being 66, I see things in a different way than I could have when I was younger. I don't think I could have written this book when I was 40. I'm seeing a lot of parallels between Karina's act of remembering and the act of writing. I think we write as a question, but we don't know the question until we get to the answer. What's next? I met my deadline on my book of poetry, Woman Without Shame. I'm working on the lyrics for the opera adaptation of The House on Mango Street, and I want Martita to be performed as a play, so I've got a lot of work to do. This interview has been edited for clarity and length. Richard Z. Santos is the author of the novel Trust Me and executive director of creative writing nonprofit Austin Bat Cave.
Thank you for joining us for Texas Monthly, the national magazine of Texas, read by volunteers and staff at the Recording Library of West Texas. You can hear this program on demand with your favorite device at recordinglibrary.org. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Make Believe Ballroom, followed by the History Book Hour at 9. Here's what's happening on the Armchair Adventure Hour. Starting Tuesday, January 31st, we're reading Love in the Time of Birdie by Alexander McCall Smith. Life for Birdie seems to be moving at a pace that is rather out of control. In Drummond Place Gardens, it seems that Olive has their future together all planned out. Meanwhile, upstairs at 44 Scotland Street, Bertie's father, Stuart, is powerless to stop overbearing Irene and her motion for Bertie to travel to Aberdeen on a three-month secondment. And further up in Newtown, while Bruce Anderson plots with old school chums, love blossoms in Big Lou's Cafe. Warm-hearted, humorous, and wonderfully wise, Love in the Time of Bertie offers philosophical insight as well as sartorial elegance. Catch up once again with the extended family at number 44 in this, the latest installment in the Scotland Street series. Love in the Time of Bertie by Alexander McCall Smith, starting Tuesday, January 31st. The Armchair Adventure Hour, every night at 10 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 44 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 30s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Cares away. All the bands are here to bring. bring good cheer your way. It's make-believe ballroom time and free to everyone. It's no time to fret, your dial is set for fun. Just close your eyes and visualize in your solitude. Your favorite bands are on the stands and Mr. Miller puts you in the mood. It's make-believe ballroom time. The hour of sweet romance. Here's your make-believe ballroom. Come on, children, let's dance, let's dance.
Hi, folks, I'm Jeff Bressler, turning on the lights of the make-believe ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for another program of the great hits of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm hosting the show to keep the music and traditions of past hosts Martin Block, Al Jarvis, William D. Williams, and the legendary Steve Allen alive. Whether you're one of my longtime listeners or a new listener on public broadcasting or community radio stations across the U.S., as well as in the U.K., grab your dance ticket, it's free, and let's reminisce. Hello world, and from coast to coast on public university and community radio stations, welcome, welcome, welcome one and all to the Make-Believe Ballroom, and thanks for joining me this hour as I share some wonderful swing jazz and big band music and many of the stories behind the records and the personalities who recorded them. I hope you're all having a great day. And you know, friends, I am just shocked. I'm in a total state of shock. If you're a regular listener, you know that over the last few weeks, we've been playing tunes from bands we have not played over the past year on this program. And much to my consternation, we have actually been void of Larry Clinton music for at least the last 365 days. So let's remedy that with this to get the Make-Believe Ballroom underway this week. On Victor Records, Johnson Rag, Larry Clinton and his orchestra, recorded in New York City, November the 2nd, 1939.
Thank you.
One more from Brooklyn band leader Larry Clinton. Then a story about a Clarinda, Iowa superstar and how he actually chose his instrument of choice. Wonder who that could possibly be. But first, another tune by Clinton, this based upon the traditional Scottish air. The Campbells are coming on Victor Records. The Campbells are swinging. Larry Clinton and his orchestra recorded in New York City, November the 5th, 1937. Jeff Bressler, and you're listening to the original Make Believe Ballroom, heard on the radio almost continuously since February of 1935. If you would like to reach me, I'm Jeff at MakeBelieveBallroomRadio.com. That's Jeff at MakeBelieveBallroomRadio.com. And one of those folks who did reach me by email this past week with a request that he wished be honored. We will read that email shortly. But first, before Larry Clinton, I said I would let you know how a musician from Clarinda, Iowa, decided on his chosen instrument. Well, it appears this young lad and his family moved to Missouri, to Grant City, Missouri, to be exact, which was...